cannibals. Goto Dengo flees through the swamp. He is fairly certain that he is being chased by the cannibals who just cooked up the friend with whom he had washed ashore. He climbs up a tangle of vines and hides himself several meters above the ground. Men with spears search the general area, but they do not find him. He passes out. When he wakes up, it's dark, and some small animal is moving in the branches nearby. He is so desperate for food that he grabs at it blindly. The creature has a body the size of a house cat, but long leathery arms, some kind of huge bat. It bites him several times on the hands before he crushes it to death. Then he eats it raw. The next day he goes forth into the swamp, trying to put more distance between himself and the cannibals. Around midday he finds a stream, the first one he's seen. For the most part, the water just seeps out of New Guinea through marshes, but here is an actual river of cold, fresh water, just narrow enough to jump across. A few hours later, he finds another village that is similar to the first one, but only about half as big. The number of dangling heads is much smaller. Maybe these headhunters are not quite as fearsome as the first group. Again, there is a central fire where white stuff is being cooked in a pot. In this case, it happens to be a wok, which they must have gotten through trade. The people of this village don't know a starving Nipponese soldier is lurking in the vicinity, so they are not very vigilant. Around twilight, when the mosquitoes come out of the swamps in a humming fog, they all retire into their longhouses. Goto Dengo runs out into the middle of the compound, grabs the wok, and makes off with it. He forces himself not to take any of the food until he is far away, hidden in a tree again, and then he gorges himself. The food is a rubbery gel of what would appear to be pure starch. Even to a ravenous man, it has no flavor at all. Nevertheless, he licks the wok clean. While he is doing so, an idea comes to him. The next morning, when the sun's bubble bursts out of the sea, Goto Dengo is kneeling in the bed of the river, scooping sand up into the wok and swirling it around. Hypnotized by the maelstrom of dirt and foam which slowly develops a glittering center. The next morning, Dengo is standing on the edge of the village bright and early, shouting, "Ulab! Ulab! Ulab!" which is what the people in the first village called gold. The villagers wriggle out of their tiny front doors, bewildered at first, but when they see his face and the wok dangling from one hand, rage flashes over them like the sun burning up from behind a cloud. A man charges with a spear, sprinting straight across the clearing. Goto Dengo dances back and takes half shelter behind a coconut tree, holding the wok up over his chest like a shield.
"Ulab! Ulab!"
he cries again. The warrior falters. Goto Dengo holds out his fist, swings it to and fro until it finds a warm shaft of sunlight, and then loosens it slightly. A tiny cascade of glittering flakes trickles out, catching the sun, then plunges into shadow, hissing as it strikes the leaves below. It gets their attention. The man with the spear stops. Someone behind him says something about pata. Goto Dengo levels the wok, resting it on his forearm, and sprinkles the entire handful of gold dust into it. The village watches, transfixed. There is a great deal more whispering about pata. He steps forward into the clearing, holding the wok out before him as an offering to the warrior, letting them see his nakedness and his pitiful condition. Finally, he collapses to his knees, bows his head very low, and sets the wok on the ground at the warrior's feet. He remains there, head bowed, letting them know that they can kill him now if they want to. If they want to choke off their newly discovered gold supply, that is. The matter will require some discussion. They tie his elbows together behind his back with vines, put a noose around his neck, and tie that to a tree. All of the kids in the village stand around him and stare. They have purple skin and frizzy hair. Flies swarm around their heads. The walk is taken into a hut that is decorated with more human heads than any of the other huts. All of the men go in there. Furious discussion ensues. A mud-daubed woman with long, skinny breasts brings Gotodengo half a shell of coconut milk and a handful of white, knuckle-sized grubs wrapped up in leaves. Her skin is a tangle of overlapping ringworm scars, and she is wearing a necklace that consists of a single human finger strung on a piece of twine. The grubs squirt when Gotodengo bites down on them. The children abandon him to watch a pair of American P-38s fly by, out over the ocean. Bored with airplanes, Gotodengo squats on his haunches and observes the menagerie of arthropods that have converged on him in hopes of sucking his blood, taking a bite of his flesh, eating his eyeballs out of his skull, or impregnating him with their eggs. The haunch position is a good one because every 5 seconds or so he has to bash his face against one knee, then the other, in order to keep the bugs out of his eyes and nostrils. A bird drops out of a tree, lands clumsily on his head, pecks something out of his hair, and flies away. Blood jets out of his anus and pools hotly under the arches of his feet. Creatures with many legs gather at the edge of the pool and begin to feast. Gotodengo moves away and, leaving them to it, gets a few minutes' respite. The men in the hut arrive at some sort of agreement. The tension is broken. There is laughter, even. He wonders what counts as funny to these guys. The guy who wanted to impale him earlier comes across the clearing, takes his leash, and tugs Gotodengo to a standing position. "Pata," he says. He looks at the sky. It is getting late. But he does not relish trying to explain to them that they should simply wait until tomorrow. He stumbles across the clearing to the cooking fire and nods at a pan full of brain stew.
"Walk," he says.
It doesn't work. They think he wants to trade gold for the walk. There follows about 18 hours of misunderstandings and failed attempts to communicate. Gotodengo almost dies. At least he feels like he might. Now that he is not on the move, the last few days are really catching up with him. But finally, in the middle of the next morning, he gets to show his magic. Squatting in the nearby stream, his elbows unbound, the wok in his hands, surrounded by skeptical village fathers still keeping a tight grip on his rustic noose, he begins to pan for gold. Within a few minutes, he has managed to summon a few flakes of the stuff out of the riverbed, demonstrating the basic concept. They want to learn it themselves. He was expecting this. He tries to show one of them how it's done, but, as Gotodengo himself learned long ago, it is one of those harder-than-it-looks deals. Back to the village. He actually gets a place to sleep this night. They stuff him into a long, skinny sack of woven grass and tie it shut above his head. This is how they keep themselves from being eaten alive by insects while they are asleep. Malaria hits him now, alternating waves of chill and heat swamping his body with the force of riptides. Time goes out of whack for a while. Later, he realizes he has been here for a while now because his broken forefinger is now solid and gnarled, and the abrasions that he got from the coral head are now a field of fine parallel scars, like the grain in a piece of wood. His skin is covered with mud, and he smells of coconut oil and of the smoke that they fill their huts with to chase away the bugs. His life is simple. When malaria has him teetering on the brink of death, he sits in front of a felled palm tree and chips away at it mindlessly for hours, slowly creating a heap of fibrous white stuff that the women use to make starch. When he is feeling stronger, he drags himself over to the river and pans for gold. In return, they do what they can to keep New Guinea from killing him. He's so weak, they do not even bother to send a chaperone with him when he goes out. It would be an idyllic tropical paradise if not for the malaria, the insects, the constant diarrhea and resulting hemorrhoids, and the fact that the people are dirty and smell bad and eat each other and use human heads for decoration. The one thing that Gotodengo thinks about, when he's capable of thinking, is that there is a boy in this village who looks to be about 12 years old. He remembers the 12-year-old who was initiated by driving a spear through his companion's heart, and wonders who's going to be used for this boy's initiation rite. From time to time, the village elders pound on a hollow log for a while, then stand around listening to other hollow logs being pounded in other villages. One day, there is an especially long episode of pounding, and it would seem that the villagers are pleased by what they have heard. The next day, they have visitors, 4 men and a child who speak a completely different language. Their word for gold is gabitisa. The child whom they have brought with them is about 6 years old and obviously retarded. There is a negotiation. Some of the gold that Gododengo has panned out of the stream is exchanged for the retarded child. The 4 visitors disappear into the jungle with their gabitisa. Within a few hours, the retarded child has been tied to a tree and the 12-year-old boy has stabbed it to death and become a man. After some parading around and dancing, the older men sit on top of the younger man and cut long, complicated gashes into his skin and pack dirt into them, so that they will heal as decorative welts. Gododengo cannot do very much except gape in numb astonishment. Every time he begins to think beyond the next 15 minutes, tries to formulate a plan of action, the malaria comes back, flattens him for a week or two, scrambles his brain, and forces him to start again from scratch. Despite all of this, he manages to extract a few 100 grams of gold dust from that stream. From time to time, the village is visited by relatively light-skinned traders who move up and down the coast in outrigger canoes, and who speak yet another different language. These traders begin to come more frequently as the village elders start trading the gold dust for betel nuts, which they chew because it makes them feel good, and for the occasional bottle of rum. One day, Gododengo is on his way back from the river, carrying a teaspoon of gold dust in the wok, when he hears voices from the village. Voices speaking in a cadence that used to be familiar. All of the men of the village, some 20 in all, are standing up with their backs to coconut trees, their arms secured behind the trees with ropes. Several of these men are dead, with their intestines spilling down onto the ground, already black with flies. The ones who are not dead yet are being used for bayonet practice by a few dozen gaunt, raving Nipponese soldiers. The women ought to be standing around screaming, but he doesn't see them. They must be inside the huts. A man in a lieutenant's uniform swaggers out of a hut, smiling broadly, wiping blood off of his penis with a rag, and almost trips over a dead child. Gododengo drops the wok and puts his hands up in the air.
"I am Nipponese,"
he shouts, even though all he wants to say at this moment is, "I am not Nipponese." The soldiers are startled, and several of them try to swing their rifles around in his direction, but the Nipponese rifle is an awful thing, nearly as long as the average soldier is tall, too heavy to maneuver even when its owner is in perfect health. Luckily, all of these men are clearly starving to death and half-crippled by malaria and bloody flux, and their minds work quicker than their bodies. The lieutenant bellows,
"Hold your fire!"
before anyone can get off a shot in the direction of Gododengo. There follows a long interrogation in one of the huts. The lieutenant has many questions and asks most of them more than once. When he repeats a question for the 5th or 13th time, he adopts a grand magnanimity, as if giving Gododengo the opportunity to retract his earlier lies. Gododengo tries to ignore the screams of the bayoneted men and the raped women, and concentrate on giving the same answer each time without variation.
"You surrendered to these savages?"
"I was incapacitated and helpless. They found me in this condition."
"What efforts did you make to escape?"
"I have been building my strength and learning from them how to survive in the jungle, what foods I can eat."
"For 6 months?"
"Pardon me, sir?"
He hasn't heard this question before.
"Your convoy was sunk 6 months ago."
Impossible.
The lieutenant steps forward and slaps him across the face. Goto Dengo feels nothing but tries to cringe anyway so as not to humiliate the man.
Your convoy was coming to reinforce our division,
bellows the lieutenant.
You dare to question me?
I humbly apologize, sir.
Your failure to arrive forced us to make a retrograde maneuver.
Nipponese army speak for retreat.
We are marching overland to rendezvous with our forces at Wewak.
So you are the advance guard for the division?
Goto Dengo has seen perhaps 24 men, a couple of squads at most.
We are the division,
the lieutenant says matter-of-factly.
So again, you surrender to these savages?
When they march out the following morning, no one remains alive in the village. All of them have been used for bayonet practice or shot while trying to run away. He is a prisoner. The lieutenant had decided to execute him for the crime of having surrendered to the enemy and was in the act of drawing his sword when one of the sergeants prevailed upon him to wait for a while. Impossible as it might seem, Goto Dengo is in far better physical condition than any of the others, and therefore useful as a pack animal. He can always be properly executed in front of a large audience when they reach a larger outpost. So he marches in the middle of the group now, unfettered, the jungle serving the purpose of chains and bars. They have loaded him down with the one remaining Nambu light machine gun, which is too heavy for anyone else to carry, and too powerful for them to fire. Any man who pulled the trigger on this thing would be shaken to pieces by it, the jungle rotted flesh scattering from jittering bones. After a few days have gone by, Goto Dengo requests permission to learn how to operate the Nambu. The lieutenant's reply is to beat him up, though he does not have the strength to beat anyone up properly. So Goto Dengo has to help him, crying out and doubling over when the lieutenant thinks he has landed a telling blow. Every couple of days, when the sun comes up in the morning, this or that soldier is found to have more bugs on him than any of the others. This means that he is dead. Lacking shovels or the strength to dig, they leave him where he lies and march onward. Sometimes they get lost, march back over the same territory, and find these corpses all swollen and black. When they begin to smell rotting human flesh, they know that they have just wasted a day's effort. But in general, they are gaining altitude now, and it is cooler. Ahead of them, their route is blocked by a ridge of snow-capped peaks that runs directly to the sea. According to the lieutenant's maps, they will have to climb up one side of it and down the other in order to reach Nipponese-controlled territory. The birds and plants are different up here. One day, while the lieutenant is urinating against a tree, the foliage shakes and an enormous bird runs out. It looks vaguely like an ostrich, but more compact and more colorful. It has a red neck and a cobalt-blue head with a giant helmet-like bone sticking out of the top of its skull, like the nose of an artillery shell. It prances straight up to the lieutenant and kicks him a couple of times, knocking him flat on his ass, then bends his long neck down, shrieks in his face, and runs back into the jungle, using its head bone as a kind of battering ram to clear a path through the brush. Even if the men were not dying on their feet, they would be too startled to raise their weapons and take a shot at it. They laugh giddily. Goto Dengo laughs until he cries. The bird must have delivered a powerful kick, though, because the lieutenant lies there for a long time, clutching his stomach. Finally, one of the sergeants regains his composure and walks over to help the poor man. As he draws closer, he suddenly turns around to face the rest of the group. His face has gone slack. Blood is fountaining out of a couple of deep stab wounds in the lieutenant's belly, and his body is already going limp when the rest of the group gathers around him. They sit and watch until they are pretty sure he is dead, and then they march onwards. That evening, the sergeant shows Goto Dengo how to disassemble and clean the Nambu light machine gun. They are down to 19, but it seems as though all of the men who were susceptible to dying in this place have now died because they go for 2, 3, 5, 7 days without losing any more. This is in spite of, or maybe because of, the fact that they are climbing up into the mountains. It is brutal work, especially for the heavily laden Goto Dengo, but the cold air seems to clear up their jungle rot and quench the ravenous internal fires of malaria. One day they break their march early at the edge of a snowfield, and the sergeant orders double rations for everyone. Black stone peaks rise above them, with an icy saddle in between. They sleep huddled together, which does not prevent some of them waking up with frostbitten toes. They eat most of what remains of their food supply and then set out towards the pass. The pass turns out to be almost disappointingly easy. The slope is so gentle that they're not really aware that they've reached the summit until they notice that the snow is sloping downwards beneath their feet. They are above the clouds, and the clouds cover the world. The gentle slope stops abruptly at the edge of a cliff that drops almost vertically at least 1,000 feet down. Then it passes through the cloud layer, so there's no way of knowing its true height. They find the memory of a trail traversing the slope. It seems to head down more frequently than it heads up, and so they follow it. It is new and exciting at first, but then it grows just as brutally monotonous as every other landscape where soldiers have ever marched. As the hours go by, the snow gets patchier, the clouds get closer. One of the men falls asleep on his feet, stumbles and tumbles end over end down the slope, occasionally bounding into free fall for several seconds. By the time he vanishes through the cloud layer, he is too far away to see. Finally, the 18 descend into a clammy mist. Each sees the one in front of him only when very close, and then only as a gray, blurred form, like an ice demon in a childhood nightmare. The landscape has become jagged and dangerous, and the lead man has to grope along practically on hands and knees. They are working their way around a protruding rib of fog-slicked stone when the lead man suddenly cries out, "Enemy!" Some of the 18 actually laugh, thinking it is a joke. Goto Dengo distinctly hears a man speaking English with an Australian accent. The man says, "Fuck 'em." Then a noise starts up that seems powerful enough to split the mountain in half. He actually thinks it is a rock avalanche for a while until his ears adjust, and he realizes that it is a weapon, something big and fully automatic. The Australians are firing at them. They try to retreat, but they can only move a few steps every minute. Meanwhile, thick lead slugs are hurtling through the fog all around them, splintering against the rock, sending stone shards into their necks and faces. "The Nambu!" someone shouts. "Get the Nambu!" But Goto Dengo can't fire the Nambu until he finds a decent place to stand. Finally, he gets to a ledge about the size of a large book and unslings the weapon. But all he can see is fog. There is a lull of a few minutes. Goto Dengo calls out the names of his comrades. The three behind him are accounted for. The others do not seem to answer his calls. Finally, one man struggles back along the path.
"The others are all dead," he says. "You may fire at will."
So he begins to fire the Nambu into the fog. The recoil almost knocks him off the mountain, so he learns to brace it against an outcropping. Then he sweeps it back and forth. He can tell when he's hitting the rock because it makes a different sound from hitting fog. He aims for the rock. He spends several clips without getting any results. Then he begins walking forward along the path again. The wind gusts. The fog swirls and parts for a moment. He sees a blood-covered path leading directly to a tall Australian man with a red mustache carrying a Tommy gun. Their eyes meet. Goto Dengo is in a better position and fires first. The man with the Tommy gun falls off the cliff. Two other Australians, concealed on the other side of the rock rib, see this happen and begin cursing. One of Goto Dengo's comrades scampers down the path, shouts, "Banzai!" and disappears around the corner carrying a fixed bayonet. There is a shotgun blast, and two men scream in unison. Then there is the now familiar sound of bodies tumbling down the rock face.
God damn it!
Hollers the one remaining Aussie.
Fucking nips!
Goto Dengo has only one honorable way out of this. He follows his comrade around the corner and opens up with the Nambu, pouring it into the fog, sweeping the rock face with lead. He stops when the magazine is empty. Nothing happens after that. Either the Aussie retreated down the path, or else Goto Dengo shot him off the cliff. By nightfall, Goto Dengo and his three surviving comrades are back down in the jungle again. Wreck. To root at arutatorum.org. From Randy at epiphyte.com. Subject. Answer. That you are a retail-level philosopher who just happens to have buddies who are in the surveillance business is simply too big a coincidence for me to accept. So I'm not going to tell you why. But in case you are worried, let me assure you that we have our reasons for building the crypt. And it's not just to make money, though it will be very good for our shareholders. Did you think we were just a bunch of nerds who stumbled into this and got in over our heads? We aren't. P.S., what do you mean when you say that you noodle around with novel cryptosystems? Give me an example. Randall Lawrence Waterhouse. Current meet space coordinates, hot from the GPS receiver card in my laptop, 8 degrees, 52.33 minutes north latitude, 117 degrees, 42.75 minutes east longitude. Nearest geographical feature, Palawan, the Philippines. 2. Randy at epiphyte.com. From root at arutatorum.org. Subject, re, answer. Randy, thank you for your oddly defensive note. Very pleased you have a good reason. Never thought otherwise. Of course, you should not feel obligated to share it with me. My having friends in the world of electronic intelligence gathering is not the big coincidence you make it out to be. How did you come to be a founder of the crypt? By being good at science and math. How did you come to be good at science and math? By standing on the shoulders of the ones who came before you. Who were those people? We used to call them natural philosophers. Likewise, my friends in the surveillance business owe their skills to the practical application of philosophy. They have the wit to understand this and to give credit where credit is due. P.S., you forgot to use the dwarfitsiblings.net front address. I assume this was deliberate? P.P.S., you say you want an example of a novel cryptosystem that I am working on. This sounds like a test. You and I both know, Randy, that the history of crypto is strewn with the wreckage of cryptosystems invented by arrogant dilettantes and soon demolished by clever codebreakers. You probably suspect that I don't know this, that I'm just another arrogant dilettante. Quite cleverly, you ask me to stick my neck out so that you and Cantrell and his like-minded friends can cut it off. You are testing me, trying to find my level. Very well. I'll send you another message in a few days. I'd love to have the secret admirers take a crack at my scheme anyway. In a narrow-hulled double outrigger boat in the South China Sea, America's Shafto stands astride a thwart, her body pointing straight up at the sun, despite the rollers, as if she is gyroscopically stabilized. She is wearing a sleeveless diving vest that reveals strong, deeply tanned shoulders, the walnut brown skin etched with a couple of black tattoos and brilliantly jeweled with beads of water. The handle of a big knife projects from a shoulder holster. The blade is that of a regular diving knife, but the handle is that of a Cree, an ornate traditional weapon of Palawan. A tourist can buy a Cree at the duty-free shop at Naya, but this one appears to be less flashy but better made than the tourist shop jobs and worn from use. She has a gold chain around her neck with a gnarled black pearl dangling from it. She has just emerged from the water holding a tiny jeweler's screwdriver between her teeth. Her mouth is open to breathe, displaying crooked, bright white teeth with no fillings. For this brief moment, she is in her element, completely absorbed in what she is doing, totally unselfconscious. At this moment, Randy thinks he understands her. Why she spends most of her time living here. Why she didn't bother with going to college. Why she left behind her mother's family, who raised her lovingly in Chicago, to be in business with her father, the wayward veteran who walked out of the household when America was 9 years old. Then she turns to scan the approaching launch and sees Randy on it staring at her. She rolls her eyes and the mask falls down over her face again. She says something to the Filipino men who are squatting in the boat around her, and two of them go into action, scampering down the outrigger poles like balance beam artists, standing on the outrigger pontoon. They hold their arms out as shock absorbers to ease the contact between the launch, which Doug Shapto has cheerfully christened Mekong Memory, and the much longer, much narrower Pam boat. One of the other Filipinos plants his bare foot against the top of a small Honda portable generator and pulls on the ripcord, the tendons and wiry muscles popping out of his arm and back for a moment like so many ripcords themselves. The generator starts instantly with a nearly inaudible purr. It is good stuff, part of the capital improvements that Semper Marine made as part of its contract with Epiphyte and Philatel. Now they are using it, effectively, to defraud the dentist.
"She lies 154 meters below that buoy," says Doug Shapto, pointing to a gallon plastic milk jug bobbing on the swells. "Yeah, she was lucky, in a way."
"Lucky?" Randy clambers off the launch and rests his weight on the outrigger, shoving it down so that the warm water comes up to his knees. Holding out his arms like a tightrope walker, he makes his way down an arm toward the canoe hull in the center.
"Lucky for us,"
Shapto corrects himself.
"We're on the flank of a seamount. The Palawan Trough is nearby."
He's following Randy, but without all of the teetering and arm-waving.
"If she had sunk in that, she'd have gone down so deep that she'd be hard to reach, and the pressure down there would have crushed her. But at 200 meters, there wouldn't have been such an implosion."
Reaching the boat's hull, he makes dramatic crushing motions with his hands.
"Do we care?" Randy asks.
"Gold and silver don't implode."
"If her hull is intact, getting the goods out is a hell of a lot easier," says Doug Shapto.
Amy has vanished beneath the Pamboat's canopy. Randy and Doug follow her into its shade and find her sitting cross-legged on a fiberglass equipment case that is entrusted with airport baggage stickers. Her face is socketed into the top of a black rubber pyramid whose base is the screen of a ruggedized cathode ray tube.
"How's the cable business?" she mutters.
Months ago, she gave up even trying to hide her scorn for the dull work of cable laying. Pretenses are shabby things that, like papier-mâché houses, must be energetically maintained or they will dissolve. Another case in point. Some time ago, Randy gave up pretending that he was not completely fascinated with Amy Shapto. This is not exactly the same thing as being in love with her, but it has quite a few things in common with that. He has always had a weird, sick fascination with women who smoked and drank a lot. Amy does neither, but her complete disregard of modern skin cancer precautions puts her in the same category. People too busy leading their lives to worry about extending their life expectancy. In any case, he has a desperate craving to know what Amy's dream is. For a while, he thought it was treasure hunting in the South China Sea. This she definitely enjoys, but he is not sure if it gives her satisfaction entire.
"Been adjusting the trim on those dive planes again," she explains. "I don't think those pushrod things were engineered very well."
She pulls her head out of the black rubber cowl and gives Randy a quick sidelong look, holding him responsible for the shortcomings of all engineers.
"I hope he'll run now without corkscrewing all over the place."
"Are you ready?"
her father asks.
"Whenever you are," she answers,
slamming the ball back into his court. Doug rises to a crouch and duck walks out from under the low canopy. Randy follows him, wanting to see the ROV for himself. It rests in the water alongside the Pamboat's center hull, a stubby yellow torpedo with a glass dome for a nose, held in place by a Filipino crewman who leans over the gunwale to grip it with both hands. Pairs of stunted wings are mounted at the nose and at the tail, each wing supporting a miniature propeller mounted in a cowl. Randy is reminded of a dirigible with its outlying engine gondolas. Noting Randy's interest, Doug Shafto squats alongside it to point out the features.
It's neutrally buoyant, so when we have it alongside like this, we have it in this foam cradle, which we will now take off.
He begins jerking loose some quick-release bungee cords, and molded segments of foam peel away from the ROV's hull. It drops lower in the water, nearly pulling the crewman over the side with it, and he lets go, keeping his arms extended so he can prevent it from bumping into them with each swell.
"You'll notice there's no umbilical," Doug says. "Normally that is mandatory for an ROV. You need the umbilical for three reasons."
Randy grins, because he knows that Doug Shafto is about to enumerate the three reasons. Randy has spent almost no time around military people, but he is finding that he gets along with them surprisingly well. His favorite thing about them is their compulsive need to educate everyone around them all the time. Randy does not need to know anything about the ROV, but Doug Shafto is going to give him a short course anyway. Randy supposes that when you are in a war, practical knowledge is a good thing to spread around.
"One," says Douglas MacArthur Shafto, "to provide power to the ROV. But this ROV carries its own power source, an oxygen natural gas swashplate motor, adapted from torpedo technology and part of our peace dividend."
That is the other thing Randy likes about military people, their mastery of deadpan humor.
"That generates enough electricity to run all of the thrusters. 2, for communications and control, but this unit uses blue-green lasers to communicate with the control console which Amy is manning. 3, for emergency recovery in the event of total systems failure. But if this unit fails, it is smart enough, supposedly, to inflate a bladder and float up to the surface where it will activate a strobe light so that we can go recover it."
"Jeez," Randy says. "Isn't this thing incredibly expensive?"
"It is incredibly expensive,"
Douglas MacArthur Shafto says.
"But the guy who runs the company that makes it is an old buddy of mine. We were at the Naval Academy together. He loans it to me sometimes when I have a pressing need."
"Does your friend know what the pressing need is in this case?"
"He does not know specifically,"
says Doug Shafto, mildly offended.
"But I suppose he is not a stupid man either."
"Clear!" shouts Amy Shafto, sounding rather impatient. Her father takes a good look at each of the thrusters in turn.
"Clear!"
he responds. A moment later, something begins to thrum inside the ROV, and a stream of bubbles spurts from an orifice on its tail, and then the thrusters begin to spin around. They swivel on the ends of their stubby wings until they are facing downwards, throwing fountains into the air, and the ROV sinks rapidly. The fountains diminish and become slight upswellings in the sea. Seen through the water's rough surface, the ROV is a yellow splatter. It shortens as the vehicle's nose pitches down, then rapidly disappears as the thrusters drive it straight down.
"Always kind of takes my breath away to see something that costs so much going off to who knows where,"
Doug Shafto says meditatively. The water around the boat has begun to emit a kind of dreadful, sickly light, like radiation in a low-budget horror film.
"Jeez, the laser?" Randy says.
"Mounted to the bottom of the hull in a little dome," Doug says. "Punches through even turbid water with ease."
"What kind of bandwidth can you transmit on it?"
"Amy is seeing decent monochrome video on her little screen right now, if that is what you mean. It is all digital, all packetized. So if some of the data doesn't make it through, the image gets a little choppy, but we do not lose visuals altogether."
"Cool."
"Yes, it is cool," Doug Shafto allows.
"Let us go and watch TV."
They crouch beneath the canopy. Doug turns on a small Sony portable television, a ruggedized waterproof model encased in yellow plastic, and patches its input cable into a spare output jack on the back of Amy's rig. He turns it on, and they begin to see a bit of what Amy is seeing. They do not have the benefit of the dark cowl that Amy is using, and so the glare of the sun washes out everything but a straight white line emerging from the dark center of the picture and expanding towards the edge. It is moving.
I'm following the buoy line down, she explains. Kind of boring.
Randy's calculator watch beeps twice. He checks the time. It is 3 in the afternoon.
Randy,
Amy says in a velvet voice.
Yes? Could you give me the square root of 3,823 on that thing?
Why do you want that?
Just do it.
Randy holds his wrist up so that he can see the watch's digital display, takes a pencil out of his pocket, and begins using its eraser to press the tiny little buttons. He hears a metallic snicking noise, but pays it no mind. Something cool and smooth glides along the underside of his wrist.
Hold still,
Amy says. She bites her lip and pulls. The watch falls off and comes away in her left hand, its vinyl band neatly severed. She's holding the Cree in her right, the edge of its blade still decorated with a few of Randy's arm hairs.
Huh. 61.8304. I would have guessed higher.
She tosses the watch over her shoulder, and it disappears into the South China Sea.
Square roots are tricky that way.
Amy, you're losing the rope,
says her father impatiently, focused entirely on the screen of the TV. Amy jams the Cree back into its sheath, smiles sweetly at Randy, and plugs her face back into the rig. Randy is speechless for a while. The question of whether or not she is a lesbian is rapidly becoming more than purely academic. He performs a quick mental review of all of the lesbians he has known. Usually they are mid-level, 9-to-5 city dwellers with sensible haircuts. In other words, they are just like most of the other people Randy knows. Amy is too flagrantly exotic, too much like a horny film director's idea of what a lesbian would be. So maybe there is some hope here.
If you're going to stare at my daughter that way,
Doug Shafto says,
you'd better start boning up on your ballroom dancing.
Is he staring at me? Oh, I can never tell when I have my face stuck in this thing,
Amy says.
He was in love with his watch. Now he has no object for his affections,
Doug says.
So, hold on to your hats.
Randy can tell when someone is trying to rattle him.
What is it that offended you so much about my watch?
The alarm?
The whole package was pretty annoying, Amy says. But the alarm is what made me psychotic.
You should have said something. Being a true geek, I actually know how to turn that alarm off.
Then why didn't you?
I don't want to lose track of time.
Why? Got a cake in the oven?
The dentist's due diligence people will be all over me.
Doug shifts position and screws up his face curiously.
You mentioned that before. What is due diligence?
It's like this. Alfred has some money that he wants to invest.
Who's Alfred?
A hypothetical person whose name begins with A.
I don't understand.
In the crypto world, when you are explaining a cryptographic protocol, you use hypothetical people. Alice, Bob, Carol, Dave, Evan, Fred, Greg, and so on.
Okay.
Alfred invests his money in a company that is run by Barney. When I say run by, what I mean is that Barney has ultimate responsibility for what that company does. So perhaps Barney is the chairman of the board of directors in this case. He's been chosen by Alfred, Alice, Agnes, Andrew, and the other investors to look after the company. He and the other directors hire corporate officers, such as Chuck, who is the president. Chuck and the other officers hire Drew to run one of the company's divisions. Drew hires Edgar, the engineer, and so on and so forth. So, in military terms, there is a whole chain of command that extends down to the guys in the trenches like Edgar.
And Barney's the man at the top of the chain of the command,
Doug says.
Right. So, just like a general, he is ultimately responsible for everything that is done below him.
Alfred has personally entrusted Barney with that money. Barney is legally required to exercise due diligence in seeing that the money is spent responsibly. If Barney fails to show due diligence, he is in major legal trouble. Yeah. That gets Barney's attention. Alfred's lawyers might show up at any moment and demand proof that due diligence is being exercised. Barney needs to stay on his toes to make sure that his ass is covered at all times.
Barney, in this case, is the dentist.
Yeah. Alfred, Agnes, and the others are all of the people in his investment club. Half of the orthodontists in Orange County.
And you are Edgar the engineer?
No, you are Edgar the engineer. I am a corporate officer of Epiphyte. I am more like Chuck or Drew. Amy breaks in. But what does the dentist have over you? You don't work for him. I'm sorry to tell you that is no longer the case, as of yesterday. This gets the Shafto's attention. The dentist now owns 10% of Epiphyte.
How did that come about? Last I was informed of anything,
Doug says accusingly.
The son of a bitch was suing you.
He was suing us, Randy says, because he wanted in. None of our stock was for sale, and we were not planning to go public anytime soon, so the only way he could get in was by essentially blackmailing us with a lawsuit.
You said it was a bogus lawsuit,
Amy exclaims, the only person here who is bothering to show or feel any moral outrage. It was, but it would have cost so much to litigate it that it would have bankrupted us. On the other hand, when we offered to sell the dentist some stock, he dropped the suit. We got our hands on some of his money, which is always useful.
But now you're beholden to his due diligence people.
Yeah. They are on the cable ship even as we speak. They came out on a tender this morning.
What do they think you're doing?
I told them that the side-scan sonar revealed some fresh anchor scars near the cable route, which needed to be assessed.
Very routine.
Yeah. Due diligence people are easy to manipulate. You just have to act really diligent. They eat it up. We're there, Amy says, and hauls back on a joystick, twisting her body to put a little English on the maneuver. Doug and Randy look at the TV screen. It is completely dark. Digits along the bottom state that the pitch is 5 degrees and the roll is 8, which means that the ROV is nearly level. The yaw number is spinning around rapidly, meaning that the ROV is rotating around its vertical axis like a fishtailing car.
Should come into view at around 50 degrees,
Amy mutters. The yaw numbers slow down, dropping through 100 degrees, 90, 80. At around 70 degrees, something rotates into view at the edge of the screen. It looks like a rugged, parti-colored sugarloaf rising from the seafloor. Amy gooses the controls a couple of times, and the rotation drops to a crawl. The sugarloaf glides into the center of the screen and then stops.
Locking in the gyros, Amy says, whacking a button.
All forward. The sugarloaf slowly begins to get bigger. The ROV is moving towards it, its direction automatically stabilized by its built-in gyroscopes.
Swing wide around it to starboard, Duck says. I want a different angle on this.
He pays some attention to a VCR that's supposed to be recording this feed. Amy lets the joystick come back to neutral, then executes a series of moves that causes them to lose the image of the wreck for a minute. All they can see are coral formations passing beneath the ROV's cameras. Then she yaws it around to the left, and there it is again. The same streamlined projectile shape. But from this angle, they can see it's actually projecting from the seafloor at a 45-degree angle.
It looks like the nose of an airplane, a bomber, Randy says. Like a B-29.
Doug shakes his head.
Bombers had to have a circular cross-section because they were pressurized. This thing does not have a circular cross-section. It is more elliptical.
But I don't see all of the railings and guns and
crap that a classic German U-boat would have hanging off of it. This is a more modern streamlined shape,
Doug says. He shouts something in Tagalog at one of his crew over on Glory 4.
Looks pretty crusty, Randy says.
There will be plenty of crap growing on her, Doug says, but she's still recognizable. There was not a catastrophic implosion.
A crew member runs onto the PAM boat, carrying an old picture book from Glory 4's small but idiosyncratic library, a pictorial history of German U-boats. Doug flips past the first 3/4 of the book and stops at a photograph of a sub whose lines are strikingly familiar.
God! That looks just like the Beatles' Yellow Submarine,
Randy says. Amy pulls her head out of the viewer and crowds him out of the way to look.
Except it's not yellow,
Doug says.
This was the new generation. Hitler could have won the war if he'd made a few dozen of these.
He flips forward a few pages. There are pictures of more U-boats with similar lines, but much larger. A cross-sectional diagram shows a thin-walled elliptical outer hull enclosing a thick-walled, perfectly circular inner hull.
The circle is the pressure hull, always kept at one atmosphere and full of air for the crew. Outside of it, an outer hull, smooth and streamlined, with room for fuel and hydrogen peroxide tanks.
It carried its own oxidizer? Like a rocket?
Sure, for running submerged. Any interstices in this outer hull would have been filled with seawater, pressurized to match the external pressure of the ocean to keep it from collapsing.
Doug holds the book up beneath the television monitor and rotates it, comparing the lines of a U-boat to the shape on the screen. The latter is rugged and furry with coral and other growths, but the similarity is obvious.
Why isn't it lying flat on the bottom, I wonder? Randy says.
Doug grabs a plastic water bottle, which is still mostly full, and tosses it overboard. It floats upside down.
Why isn't it lying flat, Randy?
Because there's an air bubble trapped in one end, Randy says sheepishly.
She suffered damage at the stern. The bow pitched up. There was a partial collapse. Seawater rushing into the breach at the stern forced all of the air into the bow. The depth is 154 meters, Randy. That's 15 atmospheres of pressure. What does Boyle's Law tell you?
That the volume of the air must have been reduced by a factor of 15.
Bingo. Suddenly 14/15 of the boat is full of water, and the other 15th is a pocket of compressed air capable of supporting life, briefly. Most of her crew dead. She fell fast and settled hard onto the bottom, breaking her back and leaving the bow section pointing upwards, as you see her. If anyone was still alive in the bubble, they died a long, slow death. May God have mercy on their souls.
In other circumstances, the religious reference would make Randy uncomfortable, but here it seems like the only appropriate thing to say. Think what you will about religious people, they always have something to say at times like this. What would an atheist come up with?
Yes, the organisms inhabiting that submarine must have lost their higher neural functions over a prolonged period of time, and eventually turned into pieces of rotten meat. So what?
Closing in on what passes for the conning tower, Amy says. According to the book, this U-boat isn't going to have the traditional high vertical tower rising out of its back, just a low streamlined bulge. Amy has piloted the ROV very close to the U-boat now, and once again she brings it to a stop and yaws it around. The hull pans into the screen, a variegated mountain of coral growths, completely unrecognizable as a man-made object, until something dark enters the screen. It turns into a perfectly circular hole. An eel comes snaking out of it and snaps angrily at the camera for a moment, its teeth and gullet filling the screen. When it swims away, they can see a dome-shaped hatch cover hanging from its hinges next to the hole.
"Someone open the hatch," Amy says.
"My God,"
says Douglas MacArthur Shafto.
"My God."
He leans away from the TV as if he can't handle the image anymore. He crawls out from under the canopy and stands up, staring out across the South China Sea.
"Someone got out of that U-boat."
Amy is still fascinated, and one with her joysticks, like a 13-year-old boy in a video arcade. Randy rubs the strange empty place on his wrist and stares at the screen, but he is not seeing anything now except that perfect round hole. After a minute or so, he goes out to join Doug, who is ritualistically lighting up a cigar.
"This is a good time to smoke,"
he mumbles.
"Want one?"
"Sure, thanks."
Randy pulls out a folding multipurpose tool and cuts the end from the cigar, a pretty impressive-looking Cuban number.
"Why do you say it's a good time to smoke?"
to fix it in your memory, to mark it.
Doug tears his gaze from the horizon and looks at Randy searchingly, almost beseeching him to understand.
This is one of the most important moments in your life. Nothing will ever be the same. We might get rich. We might get killed. We might just have an adventure or learn something. But we have been changed. We are standing close to the Heraclitean fire, feeling its heat on our faces.
He produces a flaring safety match from his cupped palms like a magician and holds it up before Randy's eyes, and Randy puffs the cigar alive, staring into the flame.
Well, here's to it, Randy says.
And here's to whoever got out, replies Doug.
Santa Monica. The United States military, Waterhouse has decided, is first and foremost an unfathomable network of typists and file clerks, secondarily a stupendous mechanism for moving stuff from one part of the world to another, and, last and least, a fighting organization. For the last couple of weeks, he has been owned by the second group. They put him on a luxury liner too swift to be caught by U-boats. Though this is a moot point, since, as Waterhouse and a few other people know, Dönitz has declared defeat in the Battle of the Atlantic and pulled his U-boats off the map until he can build the new generation, which will run on rocket fuel and need never come to the surface. In this way, Waterhouse got to New York. From Penn Station, he took trains to the Midwest, where he spent a week with his family and reassured them for the 10,000th time that because of what he knew, he could never be sent into actual combat. Then it was trains again to Los Angeles, and now he waits for what sounds like it will be a killing series of airplane flights halfway round the world to Brisbane. He is one of about a million young men and women in uniform and on leave, wandering around Los Angeles looking for some entertainment. Now, they say that this city is the entertainment capital, and so entertainment shouldn't be hard to find. Indeed, you can hardly walk down a city block without bumping into half a dozen prostitutes and passing an equal number of night spots, movie theaters, and pool halls. Waterhouse samples all of these during his 4-day layover, and is distressed to find that he is no longer entertained by any of them. Not even the whores. Maybe this is why he is walking along the bluff, north of the Santa Monica Pier, looking for a way down to the beach, which is completely empty. The only thing in Los Angeles that isn't generating commissions and residuals for someone. The beach lures, but does not pander. The plants up here, standing watch over the Pacific, are like something from another planet. No, they do not even look like real plants from any conceivable planet. They are too geometric and perfect. They are schematic diagrams for plants, sketched out by some impossibly modern designer with a strong eye for geometry, but who has never been out of the woods and seen a real plant. They don't even grow out of any recognizable organic matrix. They are embedded in the sterile ochre dust that passes for soil in this part of the country. Waterhouse knows that this is just the beginning, that it will only get weirder from here on out. He heard enough from Bobby Shafto to know that the other side of the Pacific is going to be indescribably strange. The sun is preparing to go down, and the pier, down the beach to his left, is alight, a gaudy galaxy. The zoot suits of the carnival barkers stand out from a mile away like emergency flares. But Waterhouse is in no hurry to reach it. He can see ignorant armies of soldiers, sailors, marines milling around, distinguishable by the hues of their uniforms. The last time he was in California, before Pearl Harbor, he was no different from all of those guys on the pier, just a little smarter, with a knack for numbers and music. But now he understands the war in a way that they never will. He is still wearing the same uniform, but only as a disguise. He believes now that the war, as those guys understand it, is every bit as fictional as the war movies being turned out across town in Hollywood. They say that Patton and MacArthur are daring generals. The world watches in anticipation of their next intrepid sortie behind enemy lines. Waterhouse knows that Patton and MacArthur, more than anything else, are intelligent consumers of ultra magic. They use it to figure out where the enemy has concentrated his forces, then loop around them and strike where he is weakest. That's all. They say that Montgomery is a steady hand, cagey and insightful. Waterhouse has no use for Monty. Monty's an idiot. Monty doesn't read his ultra. He ignores it, in fact, to the detriment of his men and of the war effort. They say that Yamamoto was killed by a lucky accident when some roving P-38s just happened across an anonymous flight of Nipponese planes and shot them down. Waterhouse knows that Yamamoto's death warrant was hammered out by an Electrical Till Corporation line printer in a Hawaiian cryptanalysis factory, and that the Admiral was the victim of a straightforward political assassination. Even his concept of geography has changed. When he was home, he sat down with his grandparents and they looked at the globe, spinning it around until all they saw was blue, tracing his route across the Pacific, from one lonely volcano to the next godforsaken atoll. Waterhouse knows that those little islands, before the war, had only one economic function, information processing. The dots and dashes traveling along the undersea cable are swallowed up by the earth currents after a few thousand miles, like ripples in heavy surf. The European powers colonized those islands at about the same time as the long cables were being laid, and constructed power stations where the dots and dashes coming down the line were picked up, amplified, and sent on to the next chain of islands. Some of those cables must plunge into the deep not far from this beach. Waterhouse is about to follow the dots and dashes over the western horizon, where the world ends. He finds a ramp that leads down to the beach and lets gravity draw him toward sea level, gazing to the south and west. The water is Pacific and colorless beneath a hazy sky. The horizon line is barely discernible. The fine, dry sand plumps under his feet in fat circular waves that crest around his ankles, so he has to stop and unlace his hard leather shoes. Sand has become trapped in the matrix of his black socks, and he pulls them off too and stuffs them in his pockets. He walks towards the water, carrying one shoe in each hand. He sees others who have tied their shoes together through belt loops, leaving their hands free. But the asymmetry of this offends him, so he carries his shoes as if preparing to invert himself and wade on his hands, with his head dangling into the water. The low sun shines flatly across the sand, grazing the chaos and creating a knife-sharp terminator at the crest of each dunelet. The curves flirt and osculate with one another in some pattern that is, Waterhouse guesses, deeply fascinating and significant, but too challenging for his tired mind to attack. Some areas have been stomped level by seagulls. The sand at the surf line has been washed flat. A small child's footprints wander across it, splaying like gardenia blossoms on thin shafts. The sand looks like a geometric plane until a sheet of ocean grazes it. Then small imperfections are betrayed by swirls in the water. Those swirls, in turn, carve the sand. The ocean is a Turing machine. The sand is its tape. The water reads the marks in the sand, and sometimes erases them, and sometimes carves new ones with tiny currents that are themselves a response to the marks. Plodding through the surf, Waterhouse strikes deep craters in the wet sand that are read by the ocean. Eventually, the ocean erases them, but in the process, its state has been changed. The pattern of its swirls has been altered. Waterhouse imagines that the disturbance might somehow propagate across the Pacific and into some super-secret Nipponese surveillance device made of bamboo tubes and chrysanthemum leaves. Nip listeners would know that Waterhouse had walked that way. In turn, the water swirling around Waterhouse's feet carries information about Nip propeller design and the deployment of their fleets, if only he had the wit to read it. The chaos of the waves, gravid with encrypted data, mocks him. The land war is over for Waterhouse. Now he is gone, gone to the sea. This is the first time he's taken a good look at it, the sea, that is, since he reached Los Angeles. It looks big to him. Before, when he was at Pearl, it was just a blank, a nothing. Now it looks like an active participant and a vector of information. Fighting a war out on that thing could turn you into some kind of a maniac, make you deranged. What must it be like to be the general? To live for years among volcanoes and alien trees, to forget about oaks and cornfields and snowstorms and football games, to fight the terrible Nipponese in the jungle, burning them out of caves, driving them off cliffs into the sea, to be an oriental potentate, the supreme authority over millions of square miles, hundreds of millions of people. You're only tethered to the real world a slender copper fiber rambling across the ocean floor, a faint bleating of dots and dashes in the night. What kind of man would this make you? Outpost. When their sergeant was aerosolized by the Australian with the Tommy gun, Gutto Dengo and his surviving comrades were left mapless. And mapless in the jungles of New Guinea during a war is bad, bad, bad. In another country, they might have been able to keep walking downhill until they reached the ocean, and then followed the coastline to their destination. But travel along the coast is even more nearly impossible than travel in the interior, because the coast is a chain of pestilential headhunter-infested marshes. In the end, they find a Nipponese outpost by simply following the sound of the explosions. They may not have maps, but the American 5th Air Force does. The relentless bombing is reassuring, in a way, to Gutto Dengo. After their encounter with the Australians, he entertains an idea that he dare not voice, that by the time they reach their destination, it might already have been overrun by the enemy. That he can even conceive of such a possibility proves beyond all doubt that he is no longer fit to be a soldier of the Emperor. In any case, the drone of the bomber's engines, the tympanic thuds of the explosions, the flashes on the night horizon give them plenty of helpful hints as to where the Nipponese people are located. One of Gutto Dengo's comrades is a farm boy from Kyushu, who seems to be capable of substituting enthusiasm for food, water, sleep, medicine, and any other bodily needs. As they trudge onwards through the jungle, this boy keeps his spirits up by looking forward to the day when they draw close enough to hear the sound of the anti-aircraft batteries and see the American planes torn open by shellfire spiraling into the sea. That day never arrives. As they get closer, though, they can find the outpost with their eyes closed simply by following the reek of dysentery and decaying flesh. Just as the stench draws close enough to be overpowering, the enthusiastic boy makes an odd grunting sound. Gutto Dengo turns to see a peculiar, small, oval-shaped entrance wound in the center of the boy's forehead. The boy falls down and lies on the ground, quivering.
"We are Nipponese!"
Gutto Dengo says. The tendency of bombs to fall out of the sky and blow up among them whenever the sun is up dictates that bunkers and foxholes be dug. Unfortunately, ground coincides with water table. Footprints fill up with water before the foot has even been worried loose from the clutching mud. Bomb craters are neat circular ponds. Slit trenches are zigzagging canals. There are no wheeled vehicles and no beasts of burden, no livestock, no buildings. Those pieces of charred aluminum must have been parts of airplanes once. There are a few heavy weapons, but their barrels are cracked and warped from explosions and pocked with small craters. Palm trees are squat stumps crowned with a few jagged splinters radiating away from the site of the most recent explosion. The expanse of red mud is flecked with random clutches of gulls tearing at bits of food. Gutto Dengo suspects already what they are eating, and confirms this when he cuts his bare foot on an excerpt of a human jawbone. The sheer volume of high explosive that is detonated here has suffused every molecule of the air, water, and earth with the chemical smell of TNT residue. This smell reminds Gododengo of home. The same stuff is good for pulverizing any rock that is standing between you and a vein of ore. A corporal escorts Gododengo and his one surviving comrade from the perimeter to a tent that has been pitched out on the mud, its ropes tied not to stakes but to jagged segments of tree trunks or heavy fragments of ruined weapons. Inside, the mud is paved with the lids of wooden crates. A shirtless man of perhaps 50 sits cross-legged on top of an empty ammunition box. His eyelids are so heavy and swollen that it is difficult to tell whether he is awake. He breathes erratically. When he inhales, his skin retracts into the interstices between ribs, producing the illusion that his skeleton is trying to burst free from his doomed body. He has not shaved in a long time, but doesn't have enough whiskers to muster a real beard. He is mumbling to a clerk who squats on his haunches atop a crate lid, stenciled Manila, and copies down his words. Gododengo and his comrade stand there for perhaps half an hour, desperately trying to master their disappointment. He expected to be lying in a hospital bed drinking miso soup by now. But these people are in worse shape than he is. He is afraid that they might ask him for help. Still, it is good just to be under canvas and standing in the presence of someone who has authority, who is taking charge. Clerks enter the tent carrying message decrypts, which means that somewhere around here is a functioning radio station and a staff with code books. They are not totally cut off.
"What do you know how to do?"
says the officer, when Gododengo is finally granted the opportunity to introduce himself.
"I am an engineer,"
says Gododengo.
"Ah, you know how to build bridges, airstrips."
The officer is engaging in a bit of whimsy here. Bridges and airstrips are as far beyond their grasp as intergalactic starships. All of his teeth have fallen out, and so he gums his words, and sometimes must pause to draw breath two or three times in the course of a sentence.
"I will build such things if it is my commander's wish, though for such things others have skill far better than mine. My specialty is underground works. Bunkers."
A wasp stings him on the back of the neck, and he inhales sharply.
"I will build bunkers if it is my commander's wish. My specialty is tunnels, in earth or in rock, but especially in rock."
The officer stares at Gododengo fixedly for a few moments, then directs a glance at his clerk, who nods a little bow and takes it down.
"Your skills are useless here,"
he says offhandedly, as if this is true of just about everyone.
"Sir, also I am proficient with the Nambu light machine gun."
"The Nambu is a poor weapon, not as good as what the Americans and Australians have. Still, useful in jungle defense."
"Sir, I will defend our perimeter to my last breath."
"Unfortunately, they will not attack us from the jungle. They bomb us, but the Nambu cannot hit a plane. When they come, they will come from the ocean. The Nambu is useless against an amphibious assault."
"Sir, I have lived in the jungle for 6 months.
"Oh?"
For the first time, the officer seems interested.
"What have you been eating?"
"Grubs and bats, sir."
"Go and find me some."
"At once, sir."
He untwists some old rope to make twine and knots the twine into nets and hangs the nets in trees. Once that is done, his life is simple. Every morning he climbs up into the trees to collect bats from the nets. Then he spends the afternoon digging grubs out of rotten logs with a bayonet. The sun goes down and he stands in a foxhole full of sewage until it comes up again. When bombs go off nearby, the concussion puts him into a state of shock so profound as to separate mind from body entirely. For several hours afterwards, his body goes around doing things without his telling it to. Stripped of its connections to the physical world, his mind runs in circles like an engine that has sheared its drive shaft and is screaming along at full throttle, doing no useful work while burning itself up. He usually does not emerge from this state until someone speaks to him. Then more bombs fall. One night he notices that there is sand beneath his feet. Strange. The air smells clean and fresh. Unheard of. Others are walking on the sand with him. They are being escorted by a couple of shambling privates and a corporal bent under the weight of a Nambu. The corporal is peering into Goto Dengo's face strangely.
Hiroshima,
he says.
Hmm? Did you say something to me?
Hiroshima.
But what did you say before you said Hiroshima?
In.
In?
In Hiroshima.
What did you say before you said in Hiroshima?
Aunt.
You were talking to me about your aunt in Hiroshima?
Yes, her too.
What do you mean, her too?
The same message.
What message?
The message that you memorized for me. Give her the same message.
Oh,
Goto Dengo says.
You remember the whole list?
The list of people I'm supposed to give the message to.
Yes, recite the list again.